Following the lectionary every week, it's always a challenge. And, the reading that comes from Luke is this one woman I read in the UCC church who writes commentaries every week, Catherine Matthews, says, a lot of preachers want to avoid some of these controversial, difficult passages, but I'd like to jump right in, actually. And so it is a little challenging. So when I'll be speaking from the I perspective, because I may be a minister, I may feel like I was called, I may feel like my words are in some way, hopefully, connected to God, maybe, sometimes. But it's me, and that comes through the filter of me and my own life and ego and all of that. But so we say at TAF, when we have controversial discussions around political, historical issues, whatever they are, that we say, listen 90% of the time, don't judge, and speak from the I perspective. This is what you feel, not what he or she feels. So anyhow, it's a challenging passage and Jesus came out of a tradition of, like the prophetic tradition in the Old Testament, and all those prophets, we're reading one today, Jeremiah, but all the prophets like Jeremiah, Hosea, Isaiah, Amos in particular, boy, they were in trouble all the time. They were either killed or tortured by their own people even. By their own fellow Jews, because they were challenging political injustice, social injustice. And the Bible is deeply political. When God talks about justice in the Bible, it's not punishment, that kind of thing. We think of retributive justice, and it's not criminal justice, although all societies have to have some kind of criminal justice. Nothing to do with that. It really is about redistribution of wealth and God's resources. It has nothing to do with socialism or communism. And that's why people get upset. The Bible's about redistribution of property, of God. Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and all who dwell therein belongs to God. So it's deeply political, and Jesus was deeply political. And you can't separate politics from religion and social life because they were all one. They were one thing. There's no such thing in the sense of just religion and compartmentalized by itself over here like we do on Sunday, not just you, but all of us. So I'm not even ready to preach yet, but I'm just giving you an introduction. So Jeremiah is a prophet, and he preached for about 35 so years until they were going to the Babylonian exile. And he's warning the people that they're going to go into exile if they don't change their ways. Continually there was injustice and corruption of the elites and the powerful, oppressing the poor. This is a common theme over and over again. So the Bible is a book, one rabbi said, is about justice. And I say, my professor said, justice tempered by love and compassion. God is a just God. He wants equity, and we need to create an equitable, fair society where we share. We don't have, but so Jeremiah is in trouble. He's preaching this, and all the prophets of Israel were the real prophets were called by God, and they usually had some problem. They were afraid that, Isaiah said, I'm a man of unclean lips who dwells amongst the people of unclean lips, or Jeremiah feels like he's insecure and he can't speak or articulate, like Moses said that too. They don't feel they can do it. Those are the real prophets that God calls. The other prophets, the king hires, they're on the payroll. They say what the king wants, and if they don't say it, they're executed or, excommunicated. But the real prophets, God calls from wherever they are. They might be from a wealthy, educated class. They might be a trimmer of sycamore trees like Amos. You're going and you're going to speak truth to power and you're going to challenge the king for his injustices. And so that's what Jeremiah is doing. He's warning the people, but they're not changing, and suddenly they're taken into captivity in Babylonia in the year 586 before the Common Era. They spend, 70 years or so in captivity until they're released and returned to rebuild. The temple was destroyed and all of that. So a warning, God gets a little upset when things are unjust in his, and Jesus now, in the New Testament reading, it's the Sermon on the Plain. The Sermon on the Mount? Well, this is the Sermon on the Plain. The Sermon on the Mount is an introduction to his ministry. Sermon on the Plain, a little later, he's picking his 12 apostles up on top of the mountain, and then he walks down. In the Sermon on the Mount, he's on the mountain preaching. It's a hill around Galilee. They're hills, but we call them mountain. But in the Sermon on the Plain, he comes down to be with the people. There's the disciples. And in Luke's gospel, a lot of them are Gentiles. He's preaching to the Gentiles The temple's being probably written after the temple was destroyed by the Romans. A lot of Gentiles are coming into the Christian fold. And he's with the people, he's down, he's preaching to the disciples, he's preaching to the large crowd. And it's very similar, but he has these woe passages in there. Woe to you who don't, you know, blessed are you when you do this, woe to you when you don't do that. And so let me read Jeremiah. Thus says the Lord, cursed is the man or the woman who trusts in man and makes flesh his or her arm, whose heart turns away from the Lord. He is like a shrub in the desert and shall not see any good come. He shall dwell in the parched places of wilderness in an uninhabited salt land. Blessed is the man or the woman who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is in the Lord. He or she is like a tree planted by water. This is basically Psalm 1. That sends out its roots by the stream and does not fear when heat comes, for its leaves remain green, and is not anxious in the year of drought, for it does not cease to bear fruit. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately corrupt. Who can understand it? I, the Lord, search the mind and try the heart to give every woman and man according to his or her ways, according to the fruit of their doings. And this is the Sermon on the Plain in Luke. And Jesus teaches and heals here. And before he even goes down to preach, he heals everyone. That's what he is. He's a great healer. He's a prophet, but he's a healer. He's a wisdom teacher. He's all these things. He's a Messiah. He's many things. And he came down with them, and he stood on a level place, and with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the seacoast of Tyre and Sidon, who came to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. And all the crowd sought to touch him, for power came forth from him, and he healed them all. And he lifted up his eyes and his disciples and said, blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you that hunger now, for you shall be satisfied. Blessed are you that weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when men hate you and when they exclude you and revile you and cast you out. Your name is evil on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven. For so their fathers did to the prophets. But woe to you that are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you that are full now, for you shall hunger. Woe to you that laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Woe to you when all men and women speak well of you, for so their fathers did to the false prophets. And let us pray together. Gracious and loving God, we've heard your challenging words to us this morning through our Lord Jesus, the Christ. I pray that the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart may be acceptable in thy sight, my rock and my redeemer. I mean, those are some tough words, aren't they? Would you like to preach on that? Anybody here? So I'm going to begin. You know, when I was in college, I saw my first M.C. Escher drawing, my friend's room. You know those M.C. Escher drawings? Then I noticed many students, you know, everyone was putting, college students put up posters all over the place, drawings on their walls. You know, Escher's, he has, if you're not familiar with him, he has pictures like a hand drawing another hand, which is drawing the first hand. He has drawings of castles and buildings which seem normal at first glance, but when you study them, they become architectural impossibilities. He has one drawing where soldiers are climbing up some stairs on the top of a building, but there's no top or bottom to the stairs. They just keep going round and round without ever getting higher. He has pictures of stairs that go every which way at the same time, and then they also go nowhere. Escher's drawings always evoke a double take. That is, you look at them, and they seem okay at first, and then it begins to dawn on you that something's not right with the picture. Things are not as they seem. Things are not as they seem. This is true about the world that we live in. At first, we think the world is the way things are. This is the way it was always supposed to be. We think the world is normal. And we're really normalizing this time in our lives, too. And the local and global society we humans have created is just the way the world is supposed to be. But as a minister, as a Christian like you, as a spiritual teacher, as a student of the world's great wisdom traditions, as someone who, like you, prays and meditates and constantly reflects on the conditions of the world around me, I think the world around us is not right. And I think it's not the way God intended it to be. Everything, like many of Escher's drawings, that are surrealistic, the world is upside down and it's backwards. We think that we are living on life on a planet Earth today is the way we're living is totally normal. But we're living, as the wonderful Christian writer C.S. Lewis said, we're living in a bent world. Now C.S. Lewis is this brilliant guy. He went top of his class at Oxford, was professor in literature and philosophy there, and he wrote those wonderful books, Narnia, that when I remember 25 years ago at least, we driving to Florida from Maine to see my parents and my wife, read all seven of the series, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and Prince Caspian, The Last Battle, all those books. We read four of them on the way down, three of them on the way back. It's a long trip from Maine. They're wonderful books. The kids still remember them. But the books that C.S. Lewis that relate to what I'm saying right now came before those. Those books were written in the 50s. There were these, his masterful space trilogy series. Probably not many of you have heard of that one. The science fiction novels with a spiritual message. And he got this idea after speaking to Tolkien, who wrote the Lord of the Rings and all of that, a friend of his. And he got this idea for a space trilogy series, and it's science fiction. But in these books, he reminds the reader frequently that the inhabitants of Mars, because in one book you go to Mars, another you go to Venus, another one takes place on the Earth. There are these people on Mars called the Hrosa, and they view the inhabitants of Earth as the bent ones. When angels appear on planet Earth in Lewis's trilogy, they stand, at an angle. This is not because they are off kilter. It is because humans are. That is, you and I are off kilter. The angels are straight. We are the crooked ones. In the Sermon on the Mount this morning, the Sermon on the Plain in Luke, Jesus reveals how bent we are on this planet. He's not just speaking to people 2,000 years ago. He's speaking to us today. He challenges everything that we think as normal, and he flips it upside down to show how things really are from God's perspective, at least the biblical God. And this is called the reversal gospel, really. And this Sermon on the Plain is called the reversal. And how they will be, and how God rules, how things look from God's perspective, and how they will be in all of eternity. Because of this, Jesus' message is shocking. Each statement that Jesus makes is a jolt of reality into our twisted, upside-down world. Bent world. Jesus' teachings always have, this is really important, one foot in heaven, and they have one foot on the earth. Whether the Sermon on the Mount, Sermon on the Plain, or particularly the parables. Parables are like stretch metaphors. There's one foot in heaven. This is the way God reigns and always will reign for eternity. And then he connects it to particular situations down here on the earth. And his message is this. Always, that this is the way God sees things. And this is the way God would have us structure the world. But God has given us free will. It's leaving it up to us, at least for now. The God Jesus prays to and preaches about, like the prophets before him, is deeply concerned. What's he concerned about? He's concerned about the poor. He's concerned about the downtrodden. He's concerned about the outcast. He's concerned about the disenfranchised. All the people at the margins of society that are forgotten. We don't even talk about them anymore. Remember Martin Luther King had the Poor People's Campaign? This is one of the reasons, not only because he spoke out against the Vietnam War and people told him not to, then he started going to have this huge Poor People's Campaign in March. It would have been huge, but he was assassinated when he was with the sanitation workers down in Memphis. But it would have been huge, and so it was a challenge so deep because it was questioning everything about the economic system that we have. So it was a huge threat. But let's talk for a minute about something right now in the homeless situation in the Bay Area in San Francisco. I've been there a lot. Most of us have been there. I had a church out there one summer, and it's acute. It's probably the worst in the country. And I lived in Honolulu before, you know, where I taught and had a congregational church, but that's probably the worst homeless situation I've ever seen. But when they have conventions in Honolulu, they move the homeless up the coast to the east side where it's more rural and poor. Get them out of the way so we, you know, it's beautiful. Aloha, you know. But it's a great place to be homeless because you got showers on the beach and you can kind of survive there, except it's so expensive. And that's the problem in the Bay Area. It's probably the richest city in the country. But the homeless problem is acute. And this is woman, Lilana Farhar. And she works with the UN Commission on Human Rights. And she studied homelessness around the world, in cities, poor cities like Manila, in the Philippines, Jakarta, Indonesia, Mexico City. And she says that the way homeless are being treated in the Bay Area is the cruelest of all. Wealthy neighborhoods want them out of their neighborhoods. They're even almost talking about bringing back something akin to they call it a conservatorship, something like, but almost like insane asylums. Or they had in San Francisco in the 1850s, they had ugly laws, they call them, and people that were disabled or had mental issues, they would put them away in insane asylums. But they're so angry, though. And I know there's an opioid. You read about the opioid problem? It's really bad. There are people on the streets everywhere. But why? Why are they on opium? Why are they? So the wealthy people in the Bay Area, they want them out. They're waging war on the homeless. They're stripping them of their autonomy and criminalizing homelessness. Many of these homeless people are mentally and physically disabled. In February of 2018, an unsigned flyer was posted in San Francisco's Mission District warning the homeless, "You're still here after dark tonight. The hunters will become the hunted. We will pound you, we will burn you, we will beat you, we will blank you up if you are within 100 yards of this park starting after sundown tonight." The Bay Area is home to the wealthiest corporations in the world, making tens of billions, maybe even trillions, for whom? Chevron, Apple, Wells Fargo, Google, Facebook, etc. But because of an anti-tax law called Proposition 13, the city of Oakland, for instance, is blocked from taxing the wealth, which could easily create affordable housing. So instead of blaming the homeless, why don't we think in this country of a compassionate human solution? Why not turn this situation right side up? Do you think that Jesus wouldn't challenge this? The Jesus I know would absolutely challenge this. Far too many people in this, the wealthiest country that we live in the history of the world, are working, I don't care what they say, the economy improving and all that, it's not true for a lot of people, working 3 minimum wage jobs, trying to support a family without benefits, without health care. There are millions of single moms trying to make ends meet. And if these single moms are white women, they will make 70 cents for every dollar that a white male makes doing the same work. And if these single women are people of color, they will make just over 60 cents an hour for every dollar that a white man makes doing the same work. The God that Jesus talks about cares about the homeless, cares about single moms. And this God Jesus reveals to us cares deeply about another. Here's another issue. Those who are in prison. This country, we lock up over 2 million people a year. It's growing. We have lots of private prisons. Now we're locking up a lot of undocumented people trying to come across the border. And out of a little over 8 million in the world, we lock up 2 million. We lock up a quarter of the world's people, more than China and Russia. All the people who are behind bars in the United States, the vast majority proportionally, are men and women of color, mostly who've committed nonviolent crimes, maybe drug offenses, maybe marijuana, maybe stealing or something. It might be in for these long terms. It's not the way to handle it. Certainly some people need to be behind bars who are violent. We know that. We're not living in an ideal world. But at the same time, there's bipartisan talk about prison reform, so maybe we're moving in a good direction. I don't know. Maybe. God cares about the immigrants at our borders seeking asylum, and refugees coming from Central American countries where violence and corruption is so bad they have to leave their beloved countries to stay alive. I know. I've been in Guatemala. I've been on 2 work projects with students from TAP. I've been up in the mountains building a small garage-like house, tiny. It's about the size of a tiny garage, and we just dig the foundation to lay the cement. Because the big thing is they have dirt floors. These are Mayan, mostly they're Mayan people. And because they get diseases from the kids being on the dirt floors. So we just put in a cement thing, some kind of plywood type walls, and then a corrugated tin roof. That's all we do. But the big part's the digging down and laying the foundation. And it's tremendous poverty. But then when you go down into this beautiful little town, city of Antigua, you might see in these, I guess call them haciendas, there are armed guards out front, you know, with machine guns and so forth, guarding this super wealth, just tremendous wealth. So it was just tremendous exploitation. Central America is in dire straits. And the people just coming here, they just want to be safe. You know, and really, I hate to say it, but our country, maybe we're not directly involved, 100 years of our involvement in the Americas, South Central America, has created this problem without a question. If you want to brush up on your history, read the Cornell historian Walter Lefebvre, Inevitable Revolutions. I read this in the 80s when I was working on a fact-finding commission with some ministers, Methodist ministers. We went to the United Methodist building near the Capitol. We met with refugees from El Salvador to hear their story and what was going on in the terrible war down there. So if you read Walter Lefebvre, you get a sense of U.S. involvement in down there for over a century in all six of the Central American countries. And then if you want another book, here's a good one to read. Juan Gonzalez. It's called Harvest of Empire, History of Latinos in America. Juan is a co-anchor on the program I watch every day, Democracy Now! And he also wrote for the Daily News. He had a column for 30 years. And I had him at Taft. He was wonderful. He's a very warm, gracious person. And he was in my classes, and he was speaking. He's wonderful. So it's a great book. Or you could read about the martyred Archbishop Romero, Oscar Romero, a Martin Luther King Gandhi type figure in El Salvador. He was assassinated on the altar of his church while serving the Eucharist in 1980. Assassinated while serving the Eucharist. His murderers were members of an elite paramilitary group defending the ruthless right-wing dictatorship. They call it the 14 families in El Salvador, the oligarchy. The assassins were trained right here in Georgia. School of Americas. They call it the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation today. They wanted to change the name because it's so long and you can't, but the long history of that school in Fort Benning, Georgia is frightening. They spend about 8 hours a day talking about human rights, and the rest of the several months are talking about a lot of torture tactics and all kinds of things, and they're trained right here, and we've trained thousands, and not only in Central America, but throughout South America, and it's the truth. It's a history that we have to face up to. In Guatemala, and what happened in El Salvador besides that, right after he was assassinated, maybe 9 months later at the end of 1980, four American missionary nuns, Merino nuns, were brutally raped and assassinated by these paramilitary groups trained in the U.S. You remember the story, right? You remember this. A year later, El Mazote, huge massacre of 1,000, maybe 1,200 people, children, women, unarmed men in a village, laid down, shot, raped, tortured by the same paramilitary groups. This is true. This is true. And you can read it. You can read about it. It's objective. It's not fake news. So, you know, and here we are again. Here we are again. I want to say this. Here we are again, poised to meddle in the affairs of Venezuela. Not many of support the government of Nicolas Maduro. We know he's a left-wing dictator. But before him, the leader Chavez, the working and poor people love Chavez, did a lot of good things. But since they're socialists and we don't like the socialists, you know, we want to overthrow them. He's not a good guy. It's corrupt. There are many problems. But does that mean he was elected by the people. Do we want to interfere with that and create another massive war? Because if we do that, what about the guy, Jair Bolsonaro, in Brazil, whose track record as a right-wing dictator who was elected by the people recently? He's just as bad or worse than Maduro. But he's a friend of ours. Why is that? Why is that? I don't get it. Archbishop Romero was a religious person like me. He was assassinated because his country, his world, was upside down. The rich, the powerful, the oligarchy was crushing the people. I hear Jesus' voice in this sixth chapter, verse 24. Woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. He was killed because he spoke out against injustice, oppression, assassinations, and torture. He said, as people of faith, we can't be silent in the face of injustice. Martin Luther King said something similar. Wherever there's injustice, anywhere on this planet, locally or globally, it's a threat to justice everywhere. And he said, and Romero said this 3 years before he was assassinated, 1977. It's kind of an interesting way to put this. He says, the violence we preach is not the violence of the sword or the violence of hatred. It is the violence of love, of brotherhood. It is the violence that wills to beat weapons and sickles, weapons into sickles for work. Strange, like the violence of love. But I think what he means, the violence of love is love in action, love that provokes, love that agitates, love that disturbs until justice prevails, until laws are changed, until we build a more just and equitable society for all. The day before Romero was killed, he told the army that God was commanding them to lay down their weapons. Of course, they didn't listen, shot him on the altar. So yes, it's an upside-down world. And Jesus seeks to reverse this in the Sermon on the Plain. In our upside-down world, the media, and we call the media plural, you know, print media, books, magazines, so forth, TV, radio, advertising, video games, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all of these things, what do, for the most part? A lot of it's glorifying, praising, celebrating the rich, powerful, the famous. I think it's an indoctrination of young people's hearts and minds. We're being bombarded day after day with the idea that success in this life has to do with material wealth, power, and fame. Those are things that feed the ego, wealth, power, fame. And the ego is the thing in all religions you want to transcend. And the ego is our self-centeredness, just me, me, me. And that's the thing. There's one, somebody said, this kind of consumer world we live in, it says we are just one purchase away from happiness. This may be the way of the world that we humans have constructed with our free will, but it's not the way the world should be, according to Jesus. And we may want something different, but according to Jesus, the way I read him, the way I read the prophets, who claim to present the biblical God's perspective, we can argue with that. We could argue about what we think Jesus is saying. There's a wonderful piece of Sufi wisdom. Sufis are the mystics in Islam. They're always persecuted. They talk about love and interconnection, how we're all one. It's a beautiful religion. And this I hold dear in my heart. What is honored in heaven is not honored on the earth. And what is honored on the earth is not honored in heaven. The choice is ours to make. That's why I gave us free will. We have a choice. We have a choice to how we're going to live every day. And we've also been given free will by God. We've been given, also been given hearts and minds with the ability to think, observe, analyze. And I always tell my students, question everything, question me, question every authority. Never, never, never not question. Question everything. Why? Ask the question, why? Why do we do it this way? Critique and reflect on the kind of world that we want to live in. And the kind of lives we want to live. Your choice, it's my choice. And I believe that the spiritual disciplines of prayer and contemplation and meditation can help us see through the illusory nature of the world we have built, so we can get a glimpse, maybe a vision of what God's world would be like. We turned it right side up, putting Jesus' teachings into action every day in our lives, here in the church, in our families, our communities, in our politics. It matters who's in office. It really does. Social life, and in everything we do from sunup to sundown. Although I'm not going to be like an evangelical Southern or Midwestern big megachurch that tells the people how to vote. That's ridiculous. We vote our conscience. We're free to do that. But you can't have these churches telling people who to vote for, who's Christian. You vote the way you listen to your conscience. But it does matter. If you were lost in the woods, my final thing. If you're lost in the woods here, we're in the Northern Hemisphere, you would do well to look to the North Star, to position yourself, to find your way out of the forest. We're never going to reach the North Star. How many light years away is it? It may be so, but it can guide us out of the forest. It may be too difficult to fully live out Jesus' teachings in the Sermon on the Plain, the Sermon on the Mount. I think I find it really difficult. I find it really difficult. I don't know if I can do it, if I can try. But despite our human imperfections and shortcomings, we can use Jesus' teachings as a guide, a map, better yet, a global positioning system to lead us in the direction we need to go in, both in our personal and collective lives. Turn our world right side up as people of faith so that we can follow Christ's way of living and being in this world. Amen.